The Grand National is done and dusted for another year. In I Am Maximus, we now have a horse who could bid for a third Grand National success next year. We'll be talking all about his victory and all about the Grand National Festival, plus Constitution Hill. All that and more on this week's Front Page. Hi there, welcome to this week's edition of the Front Page. As I said, then we're Grand National heavy in this week's show, but also with a focus on the flat, because we are all things to all people. I am a person, my name is Lee Mottisett. I am joined by Jonathan Harding and Maddie Playle, and we will begin by talking about the world's greatest steeplechase, the Randox Grand National, which took place on Saturday. It delivered a very different sort of Grand National to what we've become used to in recent years, but maybe more like we used to in the past. 14 horses fell or unseated on their way around the 4¼-mile course, at the end of which Willie Mullins won the Grand National again for the third consecutive year, with I Am Maximus, the winner from 2024, was the winner in 2026 after he overhauled Jordan's in the closing stages, with Iroko running on for second, and in fourth, Johnny Who. So a 1, 2 and 4 for JP McManus, now the most successful owner in Grand National history. Willie Mullins are the joint most successful trainer in Grand National history, and I Am Maximus will hopefully now bid to emulate Red Rum as a three-time winner, 50 years on from Red Rum's third success in the Grand National in 1977. First of all, let's talk about the race, Maddie, and the performance. I Am Maximus carrying top weight, first again since Red Rum to do that. A mighty performance, a mighty achievement.
It really was, wasn't it? A big weight-carrying performance off the right at the top of the handicap. Didn't look to be enjoying it all that much on the first circuit. Made quite a few mistakes here and there, but I think the cheek pieces helped him a lot. And yeah, he couldn't really be sighted in the run to the last two fences, and then just came there and took off. And we've seen that. That's been a sort of a hallmark of his last couple of runs over normal fences in Ireland, just that he's such a strong stayer. It was an exceptional performance, but I do take umbrage at direct comparisons with Red Rum, because I think so much has changed in the Grand National between, you know, those two exceptionally talented horses winning two Grand Nationals, and I don't think you can make a comparison between the two. It's a much easier race now. The jumping doesn't take anywhere near as much, and the way the handicap is as well, I think it's just a totally different challenge. But nevertheless, it was a proper performance.
Just on that, on Jonathan, Maddie makes points an easier race now, and there's no doubt the fences are easier. But I suppose you can look at easy in different ways, in the sense that if Red Rum had been running in the sort of Grand National that we have now, a Grand National that really plays to your top quality horses, he probably wouldn't have been winning that sort of Grand National. It's definitely a different sort of Grand National.
Yeah, it's tricky, and that's why we have to add all of the context. It's a bit like the Masters with Rory going back to back, Rory McIlroy, and then you look back at some of the greats in the 60s, 70s who managed to pull it off. Well, it's a completely different game, different equipment, different test. Mm. It doesn't mean it's less of a test, because it's probably more high quality that Rory was winning, just like I Am Maximus. But then, you know, it's how you kind of draw these comparisons. I think it's more of a test in the sense he's beating classy horses, but Red Rums was more of a test because he was jumping over bungalows and brick walls and God knows what else, when it used to be quite a threatening race.
Now, in terms of how threatening a race is these days, or how difficult a race is in terms of to jump round, this narrative had built up that the Grand National had suddenly become akin to a fixed brush hurdle race, and that the fences were no longer an issue. Yet that wasn't the case this year. So we had Grange Clare West unseating Patrick Mullins at the first fence. We had Panic Attack coming down at the ditch. So two of the leading fancies out of the race by fence three. Mr. Vango went down at Beaches. Two horses went down at the chair. We had loose horses contesting the finish. It was not the sort of Grand National that we have become used to. Now, me personally, as someone brought up on those old school nationals, who completely understands why the national has changed, and I don't challenge why it's changed, I agree with the changes, but there was still something quite nostalgic about seeing that sort of national. First of all, why was it different this year? Why do we think the fences were so much more hard to negotiate?
I mean, it's sort of, we're guessing a little bit. I'd be interested to speak to some of the jockeys and see how they approached it. I do wonder whether such was the focus in the last 2 years around the changes, and they were talking to the jockeys and saying, please don't do anything stupid, because there was so much focus on the national. It felt like this year was the first year that it was sort of accepted that it's changed and it's sensible and these changes have made it an easier test. Maybe then there's a corresponding shift where they're perhaps less cautious. Maybe there is less caution both from the riders and possibly even the horses who are approaching fences that are no longer quite so daunting. I don't know, it just felt to me as though there were so many fallers and unseats early, whether it was a case of they were just riding it a bit more like a normal race because they knew it is less of a test than it was. I don't know whether that had any bearing at all. I'm guessing, I wasn't riding
in
the race.
I thought, like you say, so many of those falls and unseats, etc., happened early on. And to me, a lot of the horses just weren't jumping that well. They just didn't look like they'd established a good rhythm. Now, maybe that's because they were going, you seem to think they were going too fast and that took them out of their rhythm. I'm not sure. I just think, you know, you can't legislate for these kinds of risks, and sometimes you're going to get more fallers and sometimes you're not going to get very many. I think it's just one of those things. I think it's probably sets quite a dangerous precedent to go, right, we need to dig in to see exactly why this happened, because ultimately you can't eliminate it. And some years you are just going to have more fallers than others. But I do agree with, like you, Lee, I do think the Grand National needed to change. And it probably in the future, you know, that it's something that we can always revisit if we need to. But I think, yeah, it was strange, wasn't it? For a field with such high quality horses, for me, quite a few of them. I mean, even the winner didn't jump particularly well at various stages.
Now, I mean, Beecher's second time round, he got that one wrong. And I think Connections themselves have said they probably wouldn't have been winning nationals as they used to be. He's very much a horse for the national as it is now. I thought it was a really exciting race. I mean, when Jordan's kicked clear after the third last fence, I thought Jordan's was set to win the race at that point, although 9 years earlier, I thought exactly the same when Black Lion kicked clear in almost exactly the same way. There seemed to be a consensus view after Saturday's race that Jordan's probably would have won had Ben Jones been slightly more patient. You don't agree, though?
No,
not for me either.
No way. I think the horse was a bit of a suspect stayer coming into the race anyway. I know he had good form at the track the year before, but yeah, it was crazy to see a jockey sort of pushing him along when he's already in a clear lead, sort of coming round the home bend. But I thought that was great, because we get used to this sort of them all huddling around in one big group and then it's sort of a sprint to the line, whereas this really threw it open and added a new dimension to it. But no, I don't think so. I mean, at the elbow, I was expecting him to absolutely walk in and finish about 10th, and I still think he actually stayed on
finished third.
Yeah,
he did.
I think he might have got closer had he gone later.
Yeah.
Okay. He might have got closer.
But I don't think he'd have won.
And Iroko again confirmed himself to be a proper national horse, running on for second.
Wants 5 miles, Iroko, doesn't he? I mean, he was being pushed along from some way out, and that's kind of just the way he races. But, you know, this is, I think we're going to see this more and more in the Nationals. I think we'll probably see more repeat winners now if the race stays as it is, because it just suits a specific type of horse. They're often right at the top of the weights. So who's to say Iron Maximus Iroko can't come back and do well next year?
Is that not better, though, in a finish? We had this before where, you know, so much of the reaction to that Grand National at the weekend was that was a proper national because we had all these fallers, we had all this jeopardy. You know, I'm looking at that thinking, I don't know if I like, I found it slightly uncomfortable to watch, to be honest, having watched a couple of the other ones that are a bit smoother, to suddenly then have horses falling left, right and centre. I don't know, I just found it a little bit jarring myself. And I suppose when I'm thinking of what I'd like to see now from a Grand National, you want it to be a test, you want it to be a unique test, you want it to retain that. There are going to be fallers, there is going to be drama, that's the appeal of the race. But if you ask me for what I want is top of my checklist, I want some classy horses all in contention at the finish and a proper ding dong. Like, you want 4 or 5 horses within however much. What I'd hate to see is it go back to the days of tired horses falling over the line and hardly any finishes.
But short of taking out the fences, there isn't any way of ensuring that you don't have fallers. Or I sort of take the view that you almost have to just be bold now and say, this is the Grand National. We've done an awful lot of work to the race. We have changed the fences to the extent that for some cases they're almost unrecognisable from what they were before. If you walk around and look at Beaches Brook, it's nothing like Beaches Brook was in the past. And maybe, Maddie, you're right, said that, or John, like I said, that sometimes just stuff happens.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, you can have an aberrate. Because what we saw on Saturday might prove to be the exception to the new norm.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, I hope that it is. Yeah. And I think the changes that have been made are all very sensible. I think it's a much better watch now. I think classier horses are involved. It's a different race, but I think it still retains that jeopardy, that drama, that charm. I just think you wouldn't want too many. You wouldn't want every year having 14 horses falling or unseating, ultimately.
I mean, this is a different point, but I wrote a few weeks ago in a column that I did about how just the romance is dead for me. And I must admit, I did feel that a bit on Saturday. You know, seeing a top weight, Paul Townend rode it, Willie Mullins trained it, JP McManus owned it. And yes, I Am Maximus is a superb horse, but you're talking about it being a classy race, and I understand that's the way it's gone, but I miss those stories, you know, whether it be the Dream Alliances or, you know, there was so... growing up, it's weird the stories you sort of remember about these horses. And, you know, they came from all different pockets of the country, owned by different people. It was, you know, it was something fresh every year. And it kind of made you feel like, oh, maybe I could own a Grand National runner one day. And it was more accessible. Whereas now I just think we hear from these people as, you know, incredible supporters of the sport they are. It's become almost a bit elitist for me.
See, I would counteract that by saying there were still stories potentially in Saturday's race. You look at horses like Twig, 100 quid horse.
Yeah.
Mr. Vango, if he'd gone and won, then that would have been one of the most romantic stories of recent years.
I just don't think the race is designed for them anymore.
No, it's not. But I'd also say that it's a £1 million handicap steeplechase. Mm. A race that offers £1 million in prize money almost has to have some of the best horses. If they're not in that race, then the race isn't successful. And also, I'd point out in the column today, I'm as much for nostalgia as anybody, but the Grand National of old wasn't perfect. Look at 1996, 30 years ago, there were 27 runners, so it wasn't even a full field. And of the 27 runners, 19 ran from out of the handicap. You had four horses running from £22 wrong at the weights. Now, the Grand National of today would never have a situation like that.
And I don't think it's even the Grand National's fault, per se. I think it's just the way the sport is going. Yeah. You know, there are fewer top horses and they belong in fewer yards. But, yeah, for me, there's just a little bit of the magic is gone, I think.
OK. Will the magic return next year? If I Am Maximus is... I know you say he's not Red Rum, he's not Red Rum, but if we're trying to get a three-time Grand National winner, I think that would be a fabulous thing. And also, we're not going to have that silly debate we had with Tiger Roll of Connections moaning about what weight the horse is given. We know he's going to almost certainly have top weight unless the Gold Cup horses come in there again next year. He's probably going to carry top weight. They will want to run him in the race. They will run him in the race... assuming he's fit and well. And even at 11, 1 year younger than Red Rum was when he won his third Grand National, he could do it.
He could, but I just don't think the public resonate with this horse and this story as much as a horse like Red Rum. You know, I know the race has been under a lot of scrutiny in recent years, but they always say, you know, Red Rum saved the National. And, you know, there was that first victory with Crisp that sort of got everyone hooked. I just don't think I Am Maximus is enough of a kind of a story. You know, Red Rum's trained on the beach. You know, Ginger McCain was a huge character. And I think, for whatever reason, some horses just don't quite capture the public's imagination in the same way. And he's a wonderful horse and he's clearly got a great character. And, of course, a three-time winner of the National would be great publicity, but I don't think you can compare the two.
OK. What about the general vibe of the race, John? The attendances at Aintree, we're going to talk more about the festival in a second, but the attendances were very high across the week. I mean, Thursday, they were 22% up. Friday was a sell-out for the first time in years. Saturday was basically sold out, apart from a few seats on the embankment. The ITV viewing figure was, if you include streaming and people sat at home on sofas like this, was 5.2 million, basically exactly the same as last year. Now, yes, a long way down on what the race used to get in the old days, but basically it was the same as ITV's highest audience for a Six Nations match this year. So far, by country mile, it will still be the most watched horse race in Britain or Ireland this year. For me, that in that sense, the race and the festival is still in a good place.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think the Grand National still has cut through. I think it is still a race that people engage with. Like I always say, it's my birthday and Grand National Day that some people get in touch looking to for a tip, a losing tip in this case. I think culturally, yeah, it still does have its place among those big events. You say Grand National's up there with Wimbledon in that sporting calendar, with the British Grand Prix. It kind of has that place.
And the only one that does, realistically.
The only one that does, yeah. I think that Cheltenham Festival is a massive event.
As an event, but the Cheltenham Gold Cup doesn't resonate with the public.
The Gold Cup doesn't, but I think as an event, the festival is definitely made ground on the Grand National in terms of prominence. Yeah. Definitely. I think more people resonate now with the Cheltenham Festival than they used to. And I mean, even just I was at home over the weekend and I didn't see the Grand National shown anywhere. And I didn't hear anyone talking about it or, you know, was in pubs and stuff like that. So I'm not sure. I mean, the viewing figures would also reflect that. But I definitely think it's still a big event, but I don't think it's quite ever going to be how it was.
Yeah, look, gone are the days probably where every household in Britain's watching it.
Yeah.
I think that's probably fair enough. Yeah. But that might be the same for
times
various
change.
Other sports. That's just how there's so much out there now for people to do and watch and everything else. I think it is it's very promising that it is holding its position quite firmly, I'd say, in the sporting calendar, in the British consciousness. We have the usual tedious build up with the sort of the sofa morning shows saying, should we ban the Grand National, should we ban racing, all that kind of carry on every year. It is a race that generates interest and coverage, good and bad. I just think it's still a talking point. So, yeah, and mostly in the last few years, it's felt like it's been a good story.
Yeah.
And when you talk about those debates about should racing be banned, obviously untimely on Friday, we had a really awful scenes at Aintree on a day when the Sun had run a front page was saying Zach Polanski wants racing banned. Actually, they were referring to a quote he gave 2 years ago, although I think Zach Polanski then doubled down in it on Friday, retweeting things. We had a debate on Radio 2's Jeremy Vine show about should racing be banned.
It's just quite lazy approach.
Yeah, it is
myself,
lazy. Right? It is lazy. But then in the second race on Friday, we had these awful scenes where a Gold Dancer made a terrible mistake at the final fence, lost his back legs, was driven out then by Paul Townend to win, subsequently was pulled up just beyond the grandstands, went down, suffered a fatal injury, was very sadly put down and lost his life right in front of the grandstands. There was then debate around whether the horse's action had actually gone before he crossed the winning line. The BHA's senior veterinary figure, James Given, believed that the horse's action was, as you'd expect, 3 mile chasers to be from the final fence to the line. Paul Townend said he felt nothing from the final fence to the line. Only after the horse had pulled up did he feel the horse go wrong. His explanations were noted, so no action was taken. On Friday, though, during their commentaries, Richard Hoyles and John Hunt, senior racing commentators, both said in their live commentaries they thought the horse's action had gone. There was a sense in which maybe, even if the horse's action had gone, there's no reason why Paul Tanner wouldn't necessarily have felt it. So no accusations of blame against Paul Townend. But I suppose most importantly, it was obviously a very, very sad event, and the timing couldn't have been worse.
Yeah, it couldn't have been worse. I mean, I watched the race first time, and I must admit I wasn't massively... It didn't instantly strike me, but then the moment I watched it back, I thought, yeah, he's clearly suffered an injury there. But, you know, horses are incredibly fragile creatures. And, you know, we don't actually know that he didn't sustain one injury jumping the fence or there was some sort of issue. And then, you know, horses in different paces and phases, their body goes through different mechanics. So it's no surprise to me that when he went to a trot, that is when it became apparent, because that's a different movement.
Yeah.
It's just a really difficult one, isn't it? Because how do you police these things? You know, even looking at the Grand National and Toby McKay Mitchell and Top of the Bill, you know, he was banned for 10 days after continuing to ride him. His horse fell at the last. How are we as outsiders able to look at jockeys and say, well, that's right and that's wrong, we could see it, so you must have been able to feel it. It's just an incredibly grey area, and I think ultimately it comes down to we have to have trust in our riders that they are professionals and they have the horse's best interests at heart, and we have to believe that Paul Townend didn't believe there to be an issue, because if we did, then the sport does have absolutely no leg to stand on.
I would be astonished if Paul Townend would have carried on riding that horse had he known him to be a
It's just out, it's I can't out believe the question. It would. Yeah. It's out of the question. Yeah. It's utterly ridiculous. Yeah. People suggesting that he would feel the horse go wrong and go, well, I'll just drive him out anyway. I want to. It's not like he has enough Grade One wins. If he didn't, you'd pull the horse up. Absolutely. If you feel the horse go wrong, you stop. Yeah.
But of course, the two statements, the horse went wrong at the final fence and Paul Townend did not realise the horse had gone wrong, they can both be true at the same time. It just makes it a very, very.
Like you say, it's a very, very sad event. You know, I've never known anything like that happen, certainly not for a long time. And the fact that it happened, at the Grand National meeting on ITV is really, really unfortunate. But I think it's just timing. It's just one of those things. Unfortunately, you can't foresee something like that happening. And we have to trust in our jockeys.
What I will say is you have, Willie Mullins speaking to the press about it, you have Paul Townend's thoughts, you have James Given coming out, you have the stewards' report, the details of that being sort of broadcast and pushed. Racing was actually quite on the front foot, I would say, on this, and just not defending itself in a reactionary way, just saying this is what happened, this is what the stewards have done and looked at it. You have James Given fronting up and saying we don't believe there was any, I found that quite heartening that the sport was able to just not brush it under the carpet, basically, to actually come out and say it's a very unfortunate incident, but there was no fault. I think that was quite important, because there was a lot of people watching from home, myself included, actually, just looking for detail and basically someone to say what on earth just happened, because it was an odd one to watch.
I agree with you. I suppose where some people weren't completely satisfied is where people, as you said there, Maddie, watched the race in the replays and thought that horse has gone wrong. You can see the horse has gone wrong, the action has changed, but the official line was the horse's action hadn't changed. I suppose that's maybe just one of those whereby different people will have different interpretations of what they see.
One of the things I thought as well is, the horse ran very straight, and I think that sort of supports the evidence that what Paul was feeling was that, if something would have gone wrong, he would have lost his balance, or, we can talk about this, it's just conjecture, isn't it? But I agree with you. I think the way in which it was dealt with was a big step forward on things we've seen in the past, and racing needs to keep up that line of communication, because I think the worst possible thing you can do in these moments is pretend it hasn't happened.
Absolutely, completely agree. For Dan Skelton, for Dan Skelton, champion trainer now, we can say that officially, on the final day at Sandown, he will be named champion trainer after a remarkable season and another remarkable festival. He had wins across the week. Great Dawning had that ding dong with Solness on Friday to win the Melling.
That was a great race.
It was a fantastic race. And Saturday, goodness, it felt as though the fates were decreeing that Panic Attack was bound to win the Grand National, because Dan was winning almost everything else. Four winners across Saturday, two Grade Ones on Saturday, including a first Grade One for Tristan Durrell. With Mirabad in the Michael Novice's chase. How on earth that won, I've no idea. On the bridle, and he still won. An extraordinary week, extraordinary season for Dan Skelton.
I spoke to him before, for Thursday's edition and online Wednesday, just teeing up the meeting. He'd obviously set a new British record going past 4 million. And I said, well, what does the victory lap look like now? He admitted that he had won it. And he said, well, we're going after five, obviously, and we'd need roughly 200 grand a day. And I was sort of thinking, well, I don't think he really believed that five would be possible and that 200 grand a day at Aintree would happen necessarily. I mean, he'd have hoped, but there was a certain level of disbelief, I think, on Saturday with just how well things were going. And I don't know what he's actually ended on at the end of Aintree, but if he were to get to 5 million, it's just been an astonishing season. I hate to think how short he'll be to retain the championship next year. I just might not even bother betting on it, because it's such is his dominance this season. again, spoke to him at the start of the year, and he said, if we get to 4 million, Willie's going to have to do something he's never done, Willie Mullins. And they've just blown that out of the water, even. It's been absolutely exceptional. Imagine if a panic attack had finished in the places.
Yeah, it's been incredible. And Manny across the rest of the week as well, some other big performances. Django Bailey, the Gold Cup second, won the bowl. Brighter Days Ahead.
She was very good, wasn't she? Yeah, it was great, wasn't it? We had a real mixture of sort of performances. Obviously, Lou Lamba was a disappointment for many. But just touching on Dan, I mean, I spoke to him yesterday, and I mean, I really appreciate when trainers are as sort of approachable and open and willing to talk. And I spoke to Dan on the weekend. He was due to break through 4 million, and he sort of gave me an insight into what he'd done to improve this year, regarding his placing, his training. You know, they've just got more quality, and that's something that he underlined to me yesterday. Is there's no substitute for high class horses, and he's had that this year. But it was, you could, you know, he's a very professional guy, but you could tell, he said, I'm still a bit bamboozled by it all, to be honest, just how well they ran on Saturday. And he just said, I really hope it feels how I want it to feel when I pick up that trophy. And it really makes you understand how this is the completion of a lifelong dream for him and for his whole team. And, you know, he's such a good communicator, and he's just incredibly driven, and I think this is just going to be the tip of the iceberg for what he goes on to achieve.
And just quick on the communication thing, he is, I mean, for us in the media, and therefore as a connection to racing fans, he's incredibly good, both in defeat as well as victory. He never turns down an invitation to speak, and he's incredibly engaging and interesting. And say, if he has a bad result, he's as happy to speak then as when he's had a winner.
I think he understands, doesn't he? He understands how to sell the sport as well. You know, even with Grey Dawning, you know, he's always very confident and happy to back his horses. And then if it doesn't work out, he can hold his hands up and say, oh, we did something wrong. But yeah, I think the fact that he's managed to maintain this form throughout the season, you know, he's broke his own records for number of winners in a month, and then he broke it again, and prize money's, you know, exceptional. Yeah, it's just a huge accomplishment. And I think to his team as well, you know, this is not something that Dan has achieved on his own, and or Harry indeed, you know, Tristan's a big part of that, but also all the stable staff. You know, the work they must put in to keep that amount of horses at fever pitch throughout the whole season is exceptional. So I hope they take great pride in the accomplishment as well.
It's just like Paul Nicholls used to be for me. I mean, he's absolutely obsessed.
Yeah.
And he is not obsessed in a negative way. He's absolutely obsessed, and he absolutely loves winning. And he loves racing horses, and he doesn't mind when they're beaten because he wants to find out what he's got. So he's always pitched them in at the deep end. And I know he's a big reader of sort of sporting biographies and things. He's just obsessed with competition and sport. And then when you read his quotes, and that comes across. He's like a racing fan who's kind of living his dream right at the top of the sport.
Just trying to optimise performance all the time, isn't
he? Yeah, he always wants to be better. He's already thinking about next season. I was speaking to him, you know, what do the next few weeks look like? Well, we'll run horses, we'll have a big team for Sandown, we'll run horses in the right races, and then I can't wait to get going again in May. Some of those meetings.
Yeah, and he definitely will. We will be talking flat racing in a second, albeit with a horse better known for being a jumper as part of that conversation. I wouldn't even guess who that is. Before that, though, affordability checks. We are still having to talk about affordability checks because the problem continues to exist. And as an attempt to try and persuade the Government and Gambling Commission to think again about their position on affordability checks, we had a letter, an open letter, published this week to the Secretary of State, Lisa Nandy. Around 400 prominent racing figures added their names to the letter, and it basically called on the Government to think again and halt affordability checks, in no small part because of the damage they are doing to British racing. Jonathan, the fight continues, but we are expecting the Gambling Commission to make its view heard soon on what it will do with affordability checks.
Yeah, we need to know. Look, we've been here before, haven't we? And I don't think there's a single right-minded person who doesn't think checks and balances should be in place to stop people from falling into the trap of harmful gambling and not betting within their means. I think that we'll take that as read.
Yeah.
It is the tools you deploy and the mechanisms you use to ensure that's the case. And I think the general consensus is, even if you think there should be financial risk checks or affordability checks, in their current guise, how they're being piloted and how they're being received, this doesn't feel like the right tool to reach that end of sort of tackling problem gambling. It just feels, still feels much too heavy-handed, and it feels as though the collateral damage is such that it is not being considered as it ought to be, certainly for racing, but just generally it just feels as though a lot of, too many people are going to be sucked into this, and it's there's a lot of, if you're going to introduce them, an awful lot more work needs to be done on how they'll be introduced and the technology and all the rest of it, because it feels as though they're being pushed through on a sort of, through some sort of moral objection, as opposed to it making actual sense to have them.
Yeah. One point I made in a column last month was that I thought the checks at the moment are not just bad policy, but bad politics, and that there was no great political win for Starmer's government in doing them. And just reading this letter, I think I'm not the only one that's thinking that, because I just thought there's some subtle hints in that direction. The third paragraph began, "It was the last Conservative government that proposed affordability checks as part of its gambling policy." Further down it says, "Your government demonstrated it recognised this risk when the Chancellor used a budget to give the Gambling Commission 26 million quid to tackle the burgeoning black market." And at the end, "It is not too late for you to reconsider the unintended consequences of your predecessor's policies and save our bets to secure British horse racing's future." I think it feels like British Racing is saying to Starmer that, look, if you go for one of your U-turns on this, and there have been a few U-turns with this government, but if you do that, you're actually only U-turning on your predecessor's policy, and there's no damage to your reputation by doing this. Well, it's quite clever.
It is clever, and you just want to avoid policy for policy's sake. It's not a case of, well, this has been going on for so long, well, let's go right to the bitter end because we've come this far. I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, we piloted it, it didn't work, let's go back to the drawing board. I think that's preferable for everybody. It just feels to me like we're in that position of, well, we're just going through the motions, it's going to happen. It almost feels inevitable when it doesn't need to be. I think it's, as I say, I'll say it again, you can have the well-intended idea, you can pilot it, you can gather all the evidence, and then you turn around and say, actually, we didn't anticipate that push to the black market, we didn't anticipate the hit to horse racing. That's fine to then turn around and go, well, these are our findings. That might be useful down the line. You have this body of evidence and you go, someone might have a really bright idea of how you tackle problem gambling using all this evidence that doesn't have these consequences. Yeah. But until you can tick off all of them and go, well, we're not going to drive people to the black market, we're not going to irreparably damage horse racing, then why press ahead with it? I just think it's not, take being a fan of horse racing out of it, or take being somebody who likes to bet out of it. I just think it doesn't make a huge amount of sense currently. I haven't seen enough evidence to say this is a good idea yet.
Yeah.
Maybe it's coming, who knows? But until that time, why press ahead?
Absolutely. And on that front as well, alongside the letter that was published last week, there is now an online portal with which you can add your name to a letter to your MP calling on the government to hold affordability checks, and there is a QR code on the screen now. If you use that, you will be able to send one of those letters. The flat season is gathering pace, and Maddie, there was good stuff at Leopardstown yesterday. We had the Derby Antipost favourite Pierre Bonnard running at Leopardstown, and he's no longer the Derby Antipost favourite.
No, he's not. He won the Criterium de Saint-Cloud at the tail end of last year. For me, the best looking, I wrote that in the punting panel on Saturday, the best looking juvenile that I've seen in a long, long time, Son of Camelot. It was the same case again, wasn't it? The Albert Einsteins. You know, he beat two horses home. Maybe he was racing on a disadvantageous part of the track. Maybe it was a bit softer there in the middle, and the winner Christmas Day came sort of closer to the stand side to beat Endorsement, but he can never really truly threaten, and I don't think Ryan Moore, you could tell by his body language, he was never quite happy with the rhythm that he was in. Initially he was quite prominent and then he got knocked back. but it's just a minefield, isn't it? How do we know what to expect? Well, you can't say, oh, it's a fitness issue, because Aidan O'Brien's sources are, you know, are winning elsewhere, including in that race, yeah. Lee. And as you pointed out, I believe he'd been part of a race course gallop, so he can't have been too far off, I would have thought, Pierre Bonnard. But we've seen it, you know, whether it's City of Troy or Gus Rodin, probably Albert Einstein, they're going to come back and leave that form well behind. I think, you know, there are things we can point to why that might be the case, whether it be the ground first time out this season, whether it be just wasn't on a going day. But I do feel for people betting in these races, because it's just so hard to understand how that could happen. You know, the winner was a Group 3 winner and a talented horse who, you know, we'd expect him to improve for the step up in trip, given his pedigree and the stamina in that being by Camelot. But it's just a bit bizarre, isn't it? We almost think that Aidan O'Brien uses this stage of the season to get his horses fit these days, but then I guess some are naturally going to be fitter than the others, but how much of that is ability, how much of that is conditioning, it's just impossible to know. So yeah, I wouldn't be betting on any Aidan O'Brien horses in these trials, I don't think, because it's just too risky for me. I wouldn't write off Pierre Bonnard, but he was given a very, very easy time of it in the closing stages, and he's going to need to step up on that a huge amount to even be competitive.
Yeah, more classic trials will take place at Newmarket, obviously, with the Craven meeting, and then again at Newbury on Saturday when it stages the Greenham and the Fred Darling. But now centre to that card at 2:35, having been moved from the first race on the card, is the John Porter Stakes. And the reason why is a horse, again, you might have heard of, Constitution Hill. So he's due to have his first start in a group race on Saturday. We're talking now, recording about half an hour before entries close for that race. He has been entered in it, but also entered in it is Pride of Arras, 115 rated winner of the Dante and Great Voltager. Eden from Andrew Balding's yard, 114 rated. Convergent, 116 rated from Carl Burke's yard. Al-Acy, 115 from the William Haggis stable. A few others besides as well. But Jonathan Constitution Hill is rated 101. So he needs to find probably at least a stone of improvement to win on Saturday. It's going to be fascinating to see what happens.
Yeah, it will. I think everyone from those first two starts had this idea of maybe he's right on that cusp of being a group horse at that level. Mm. You don't get more kind of group horse than like an Al-Azi. They're just, you can set your
solid
watch to them. That's a very solid benchmark. So you can almost look at this race as where he finishes relative to a horse like that will give you an idea. I did half wonder whether they would look at that step that he needs to take and think, maybe we go handicapping early and stick to that and start looking at those really valuable handicaps instead of trying to see whether he's group class potentially and protect it, the mark a little bit. But look, there's not beyond the realms of possibility, is it, that he could take a big step forward. The noises around him are very much, you know, the people who've sat on it, Machine Murphy and the like, are saying there is a lot of improvement to come. I think he'll be better in a better race. Whether he can improve a stone, I don't know, but it would be a heck of a story if he does, wouldn't it?
What's your hunch, buddy?
I was just, my ears were pricked up by you saying Convergent was in there. I think he's a very, very good horse and could be a Group 1 contender for Carl Burke this year. He's already flying, as he was last season. It's a lot to do, isn't it? I know you're saying protect their mark, and that would make sense in a lot of ways, but at the same time, you know, he's a 9-year-old, and if they're going to go for a race like this, then why not just go for it? I'd have a few concerns about the ground, though.
Good to firm the moment.
Yeah, at the moment. Listen, I know he's obviously been on all weather tracks so far on the flat, and he's used to that and he handles it. I'm not saying it necessarily will be an issue, but given how sort of careful Nicky Henderson is with his horses, and given he is a jumps bred horse and that's what he's bred to do, he's built slightly differently, whether that will temper enthusiasm nearer the race, I'm not sure. What do you think?
I think it'd be interesting, because they have said all along they don't think he wants fast ground. I suppose we're talking about spring good to firm as opposed to June, July good to firm, but they would have other options. You could go for the Almond Stakes, go for the Henley Second Stakes.
How different do you think those things are?
Well, people say that, don't they? People say that, like, winter soft ground is different to spring soft ground. I don't know.
I suppose it's because you've got the sort of the layers of the ground, yeah. And you know, the top might be soft and underneath, and it, how it drains and all the rest of it. But yeah, if it's good to firm, that's going to be fast enough, I'd have thought. Not saying he can't handle it, but just saying it'll be a point of interest.
You can look really clever here, Lee. Does he win a few runs? And then you can come back and look at this and clip it on social media.
Does he win if he runs? Anyway, so that was a fascinating programme. I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you to Jonathan. Thank you to Maddie. I am sitting on the fence. I will tell you next week if he won or didn't win. Until then, thanks for watching. Bye-bye.